such as the Morbidity and Mortality Weekly Report and websites, not only provide reading that is by turns gripping, hilarious, and heart-wrenching, but also tell you the mistakes other people have made. Then you can be on the lookout for similar situations and perhaps avoid them. Wasn't this the cave where those scuba divers drowned? Be humble. A Navy SEAL commander told Al Siebert, the psychologist who studies survival, that the Rambo types are the first to go. Don't think that just because you're good at one thing, it makes you good at other things. People in business make that mistake all the time, as the history of Xerox, A&P, Digital Equipment Corporation, and numerous other companies demonstrate. Captain Gaba was no doubt a fine Army Ranger, but as much as he knew, he didn't know enough about fast-moving rivers, and he didn't know that he didn't know. So he drowned. The other side of this principle is the danger of success. John Bouchard, who is also a paraglider pilot, describes it, "You have 100 hours. You think you understand it. You know how to thermal. You've done some cross-country trips. You've been up to the cloud base. You've flown 20 miles, and you think you understand. Then you push it. Look out." During the 1992 National Paragliding Championships at Owens Valley in California, his friend Leo had his first big flight 2 days before practice, with an 8,000-foot gain and 40 miles cross-country from Bishop to Mena, Nevada. The next day, Bouchard said, he was low, trying to catch a thermal, and it was a big thermal. It tipped the glider, and he spun out of control. He tried to recover rather than throw his reserve chute, and he hit the ground and died. If he had not had that unbelievable flight the day before, I think he would have thrown his reserve. Leo had developed a new secondary emotion, and it killed him. These sports are different in that you need a mentor. You need it more after you've learned the basics than at first. In climbing, you find a mentor and attach yourself to him, someone who's been there. Part of knowing yourself is through your mentor. Those who gain experience while retaining firm hold on a beginner's state of mind become long-term survivors. In flying, we constantly go back and retrain to remind ourselves that Newton's laws don't get suspended just because we've become so goddamn studly. That's hard to remember when you feel like all you have to do is find a phone booth, get that cape on, and leap out the nearest window. We have a saying, there are old pilots and bold pilots, but there are no old, bold pilots. That's true in all hazardous pursuits. When in doubt, bail out. This is a tough one. You've paid for airfare. You've waited all year for this trip. You've bought all your equipment. It's hard to admit that things aren't going to go your way. At times like that, it's good to ask yourself if it's worth dying for. Of course, some people need to get close to death to take the really big risk. Or as a friend of mine who is a Chicago cop once told me, some people just want to die in a hail of police gunfire. But as Boone Brackett used to say, I'd much rather be on the ground wishing I were in the air than in the air wishing I were on the ground. Gary Hoff pulled out of the Illinois River when he saw 18-inch trees shooting past him at 15 miles an hour, while others drowned. David Stone was struck by lightning on the southeast buttress of Cathedral Peak because of an inflexible plan, a failure to have a bailout plan, and perhaps even a bit of difficulty with impulse control, a difficulty that all of us who pursue adventure have. Drew Lehman is director of risk management for the National Outdoor Leadership School, which trains the guides and guides the trainers in anything from whitewater kayaking to snowboarding. You need humility, Lehman said, in order to resign in time. We say at Knowles, the summit is not the only place on the mountain. Maybe you've tried to climb this peak for 5 years, and maybe you're on the third try and the weather is getting lousy again. Some people get caught up in thinking, I just spent all my money to get here and I'm not going to let some storm ruin it for me, Lehman said. At that moment, you need to be able to look within yourself and say, it's not going to happen this year either. Otherwise, you run the risk of going for it and having unfortunate consequences. It's a matter of looking at yourself and assessing your own abilities and where you are mentally, and then realizing that it's better to turn back and get a chance to do it again than to go for it and not come back at all. We are a society of high achievers, but in the wilderness, such motivation can be deadly sometimes. Be realistic about your goals and your time frame, Lehman advised. Then be content with being outdoors. If you can get to the summit, that's just the icing. When trouble comes, in whatever form, the same rules apply and a few others too. You have to have that positive mental attitude. Blaming others is a national pastime with the frivolous lawsuits to prove it. That's not a survivor's attitude. But Steve Callahan's observation that he had a view of heaven from a seat in hell was. He was looking at the glass as half full. Regarding self-pity, Stockdale reflected on the value of having read the book of Job. When the Lord appeared in the whirlwind, he said, "Now, Job, you have to shape up. Life is not fair." This was a great comfort to me in prison. It answered the question, "Why me?" It cast aside any thoughts of being punished for past actions. But that attitude won't magically appear when you need it. It has to develop throughout life as a way of looking at the world, and it's worth working on since it sets you up for success in any situation. It sets you up to be a rescuer, not a victim. Jim Stockdale believed, as I do, that the Stoic philosophers had it right when it came to survival as a way of life. How else could you describe Joe Simpson and Steve Callahan's attitude if not Stoic and philosophical? Stockdale also recommends a course of familiarization with pain. Some survival schools can provide that. Trips into the wilderness can provide it unexpectedly, too. By embracing the natural pain that occurs in everyday life, you are practicing for a survival situation. A survival situation may occur in the wilderness, but it may also occur as war, illness, business failure, the need to get out of a burning building, and in numerous other forms. The reason Marcus Aurelius sounds as if he's writing a survival manual is because, at the time he wrote his Meditations, he was the general in charge of a very trying war, which he ultimately won. In summarizing what Marcus Aurelius had said, Irwin Edmond, in his introduction to the Meditations, wrote, "Fortitude is necessary, and patience and courtesy and modesty and decorum and a will in what may for the moment seem to be the worst of worlds, to do one's best." He wrote those words during World War II, when the Allies were in a desperate fight for survival. The same applies to any survival situation. I've been reading accident reports of various kinds for 30 or more years. Call me callous, but to me they're like silent comedy movies. People do the strangest things and get themselves into the most amazing predicaments. You want to go wake up Tolstoy and Dostoevsky and say, "Hey, you think your characters are crazy?" In reading about cases in which people survived seemingly impossible circumstances, however, I found an eerie uniformity. Decades and sometimes even centuries apart, separated by culture, geography, race, language, and tradition. They all went through the same patterns of thought and behavior. I eventually distilled those observations down to 12 points that seemed to stand out concerning how survivors think and behave in the clutch of mortal danger. Some are the same as the steps for staying out of trouble. Here's what survivors do. 1. Perceive, believe. Look, see, believe. Even in the initial crisis, survivors' perceptions and cognitive functions keep working. They notice the details and may even find some humorous or beautiful. If there is any denial, it is counterbalanced by a solid belief in the clear evidence of their senses. They immediately begin to recognize, acknowledge, and even accept the reality of their situation. "I've broken my leg, that's it, I'm dead," as Joe Simpson put it. They may initially blame forces outside themselves too, but very quickly they dismiss that tactic and recognize that everything, good and bad, emanates from within. They see opportunity, even good, in their situation. They move through denial, anger, bargaining, depression, and acceptance very rapidly. they go inside. Bear in mind, though, that many people, such as Debbie Kiley, may have to struggle for a time before they get there. 2. Stay calm. Use humor. Use fear to focus. In the initial crisis, survivors are making use of fear, not being ruled by it. Their fear often feels like and turns into anger, and that motivates them and makes them sharper. They understand at a deep level about being cool and are ever on guard against the mutiny of too much emotion. They keep their sense of humor and therefore keep calm. 3. Think, analyze, plan. Get organized. Set up small, manageable tasks. Survivors quickly organize, set up routines, and institute discipline. In successful group survival situations, a leader emerges often from the least likely candidate. They push away thoughts that their situation is hopeless. A rational voice emerges and is often actually heard, which takes control of the situation. Survivors perceive that experience as being split into two people, and they obey the rational one. It begins with the paradox of seeing reality, how hopeless it would seem to an outside observer, but acting with the expectation of success. 4. Take correct, decisive action. Be bold and cautious while carrying out tasks. Survivors are able to transform thought into action. They are willing to take risks to save themselves and others. They are able to break down very large jobs into small, manageable tasks. They set attainable goals and develop short-term plans to reach them. They are meticulous about doing those tasks well. They deal with what is within their power from moment to moment, hour to hour, day to day. They leave the rest behind. 5. Celebrate your successes. Take joy in completing tasks. Survivors take great joy from even their smallest successes. That is an important step in creating an ongoing feeling of motivation and preventing the descent into hopelessness. It also provides relief from the unspeakable stress of a true survival situation. 6. Count your blessings. Be grateful. You're alive. This is how survivors become rescuers instead of victims. There is always someone else they are helping more than themselves, even if that someone is not present. One survivor I spoke to, Yossi Ginsberg, who was lost for weeks in the Bolivian jungle, hallucinated about a beautiful companion with whom he slept each night as he traveled. Everything he did for her. 7. Play. Sing, play mind games, recite poetry, count anything, do mathematical problems in your head. Since the brain and its wiring appear to be the determining factor in survival, this is an argument for expanding and refining it. The more you have learned and experienced of art, music, poetry, literature, philosophy, mathematics, and so on, the more resources you will have to fall back on. Just as survivors use patterns and rhythm to move forward in the survival voyage, they use the deeper activities of the intellect to stimulate, calm, and entertain the mind. Counting becomes important, too, and reciting poetry or even a mantra can calm the frantic mind. Movement becomes dance. One survivor who had to walk a long way counted his steps, 100 at a time, and dedicated each 100 to another person he cared about. Stockdale cites love of poetry as an important quality for enduring. You thirst to remember, he wrote. The clutter of all the trivia evaporates from your consciousness, and with care you can make deep excursions into past recollections. Verses were hoarded and gone over each day. The person who came into this experiment with reams of already memorized poetry was the bearer of great gifts. Survivors often cling to talismans. They search for meaning, and the more you know already, the deeper the meaning. They engage the crisis almost as a game. They discover the flow of the expert performer in whom emotion and thought balance each other in producing action. Careful, careful, they say, but they act joyfully and decisively. Playing also leads to invention, and invention may lead to a new technique, strategy, or a piece of equipment that could save you. 8. See the beauty. Remember, it's a vision quest. Survivors are attuned to the wonder of the world. The appreciation of beauty, the feeling of awe, opens the senses. When you see something beautiful, your pupils actually dilate. This appreciation not only relieves stress and creates strong motivation, but it allows you to take in new information more effectively. 9. Believe that you will succeed. Develop a deep conviction that you'll live. All of the practices just described lead to this point. Survivors consolidate their personalities and fix their determination. Survivors admonish themselves to make no more mistakes, to be very careful, and to do their very best. They become convinced that they will prevail if they do those things. 10. Surrender. Let go of your fear of dying. Put away the pain. Survivors manage pain well. Lauren Elder, who walked out of the Sierra Nevada after surviving a plane crash, wrote that she stored away the information, "My arm is broken." That sort of thinking is what John Leach calls resignation without giving up. It is survival by surrender. Joe Simpson recognized that he would probably die, but it had ceased to bother him, and so he went ahead and crawled off the mountain anyway. 11. Do whatever is necessary. Be determined. Have the will and the skill. Survivors have meta-knowledge. They know their abilities and do not over or underestimate them. They believe that anything is possible and act accordingly. Play leads to invention, which leads to trying something that might have seemed impossible. When the plane in which Lauren Elder was flying hit the top of a ridge above 12,000 feet, it would have seemed impossible that she could get off alive. She did it anyway, including having to downclimb vertical rock races with a broken arm. Survivors don't expect or even hope to be rescued. They are coldly rational about using the world, obtaining what they need, doing what they have to do. 12. Never give up. Let nothing break your spirit. There is always one more thing that you can do. Survivors are not easily frustrated. They are not discouraged by setbacks. They accept that the environment, or the business climate, or their health, is constantly changing. They pick themselves up and start the entire process over again, breaking it down into manageable bits. Survivors always have a clear reason for going on. They keep their spirits up by developing an alternate world made up of rich memories to which they can escape. They mine their memory for whatever will keep them occupied. They come to embrace the world in which they find themselves and see opportunity in adversity. In the aftermath, survivors learn from and are grateful for the experiences they've had. John Gray is the only guide licensed to take backpackers into Glacier National Park. His company, Glacier Wilderness Guides, runs the Granite Park Chalet there. The Highline Trail is a very popular spot in the park. People set off from their Winnebagos in the vast Logan Pass Visitor Center parking lot, a place where it can snow 12 inches in August. They walk with their kids and their cameras right out along the Continental Divide for beautiful views. "They're just clueless when they start," Gray told me. "They don't even realize that being in the mountains, you have to be prepared. A ton of people take off up there without proper equipment, and it rapidly becomes a life-threatening situation. This year at Granite Park Chalet, we gave away every garbage bag we had to people who had come up without proper clothes and were hypothermic. We could warm them up, but the garbage bag was the only thing we could give them for the walk back down." "There's the allure of the unknown, and that can be compelling," Drew Lehman said, "to just want to go off without knowing what's out there. But it's important to do some homework first and to understand what kind of conditions you might be going into. That will determine your equipment, your route, your goals, and the amount of time you allow to achieve them." Gray, Lehman, and others emphasize the essential tools of adventure: planning, caution, training, and learning some good decision-making skills. The astronauts provide us with an excellent example. Never has there been a more celebrated group of thrill-seekers, yet they, more than any other single group, understand that their lives are not their own to throw away. We are a nation of adventurers, and they belong to us, not only because we pay their way, but also because they are the embodiment of that deep, abiding spirit of adventure and exploration that has always been essential to our national identity. They engage in an activity that is predictably lethal. Some of them are going to die, and they're going to do it on a fairly regular schedule. But when they do, we can feel secure in celebrating their lives and the assiduous attention to detail that went into their efforts to come back safely. Everyone is a hero to someone back home. If someone doesn't come back, then others, in the form of search and rescue crews, will have to put their lives at risk during a rescue or body recovery. The real heroism of the astronauts is not in the risks they take. Any idiot can throw his life away. But in the much more arduous lengths to which they go to protect themselves from harm. They know that adventure becomes folly when you stop looking out for number one. It's not selfishness. It's that fine distinction between going forth boldly and going forth blindly, a balance between dedication to the mission and informed caution. It takes real skill to strike that balance. And at their best, adventurers are both bold and cautious. That means knowing where the envelope ends, and moreover, knowing yourself well enough to estimate correctly just how far beyond it you can go and still get back. I've watched as astronauts, such as Bob Cabana, Jerry Ross, and Jim Newman, who did the first assembly of the International Space Station, become masters of their mission. They studied everything, practiced every move, and trained half a decade for a task that took 2 weeks. It's the secret of their success. By the time they get to the real mission, it seems like just one more drill. It's familiar, and that allows clear thinking. A panicked mind is a useless mind. The outcome of a survival situation depends largely on your mental, emotional, and physical condition and activities. Everyone who meets catastrophe or challenge and survives it through his or her own actions goes through an initial transformation from victim to survivor and also follows a well-defined pattern of mental and emotional checks, controls, actions, and transformations. Those activities, such as the split of the rational from the emotional self and the sudden, almost blinding insight that one is going to live, are far more important in predicting survival than any particular skill, training, or equipment. Those mental processes and transformations reflect actual brain activity that scientists are just beginning to understand. People who engage in wilderness recreation or risky outdoor sports can benefit from learning about such processes and transformations. Everyone has finite resources going into a catastrophe. It is in managing those resources and taking advantage of every bit of luck that comes along that survivors have been able to bring out their stories. There is no telling how many people behave and adapt as perfect textbook survivors, only to die owing to extreme objective hazards that even the best behavior cannot overcome. In other words, you may do everything right and still die. Likewise, you may do everything wrong and live, as so many do every day. Not long ago, when I was flying the aerobatics contest circuit, a friend of mine, Jan Jones, was going about her ordinary business. She had started with the International Aerobatics Club at about the same time as I did. Jan was an otherwise fairly ordinary person. She went to the grocery store, took a shower every morning, watched TV, did laundry. She and her husband went to the movies. Like me, Jan was a judge, and sometimes we'd sit together while others flew. Then one day she took off, crashed her pits, and died. People talked gravely about the unnecessary risks she'd taken. But another friend of mine was doing the very same everyday errands and activities, but not flying, not taking the risks. In fact, she lived an extremely quiet life. Then one day she felt ill and went to the doctor, and a few weeks later was dead from glioblastoma. Survivors know, whether they are conscious of it or not, that to live at all is to fly upside down. 640 people died in 1999 while choking on food. 320 drowned in the bathtub. You're already flying upside down. You might as well turn on the smoke and have some fun. Then, when a different sort of challenge presents itself, you can face it with the same equanimity. D.H. Lawrence wrote that every year you pass an anniversary unaware, the anniversary of your own death. I've seen it so many times before, as adventurers circle and circle the spot marked X where they meet their own death, taunting it, teasing it, playing with the big cat. Never fool yourself into thinking you can tame it. Sure, we do it in our ordinary lives, too. You can get killed on your lunch break, but we do that blindly. In our adventures, we engage fate deliberately. We choose a relentless and indefatigable opponent, while others pretend to be safe. We feel that our experiences are much more real, while seeing the masses as deluded in their complacency. When well-trained people are fetched off by fate during a well-planned and thoughtful expedition, there is no more ignominy in it than when an ordinary Joe gets hit by a bus. No one says he shouldn't have been walking there. But a climber named Carl Iwan, unfamiliar with Three-Fingered Jack, a volcanic mountain in Oregon which he was descending, left his companions, left the trail, left his ice axe strapped to his pack, and ventured out onto the snow, where he treated his companions to a spectacular show as he slid into the couloir and did a 600-foot Peter Pan. Carl did not die doing what he loved. He died of poor impulse control, or what I call the rapture of the shallow. The perfect adventure shouldn't be that much more hazardous in a real sense than ordinary life, for that invisible rope that holds us here can always break. We can live a life of bored caution and die of cancer. Better to take the adventure, minimize the risks, get the information, and then go forward in the knowledge that we've done everything we can. No, some people would rather not see it, but the bull is there for all of us. Some of us choose to pass the cape in front of its horns. To live life is to risk it. And when you feel the rush of air and catch the stink of hot breath in your face, you enter the secret order of those who have seen their own death close up. It makes us live that much more intensely. So intense is it, for some, that it seals their fate. Once they've tasted it, they just can't stop. And in their cases, perhaps we have to accept that the light that burns brightest burns half as long. But I believe that if you do it right, you can have it all. I adhere to what my daughter Amelia calls the gutter theory of life. It goes like this. You don't want to be lying in the gutter, having been run down by a bus, the last bit of your life ebbing away, and be thinking, I should have taken that rafting trip, or I should have learned to surf, or I should have flown upside down with smoke. Pete Conrad was the third man to walk on the moon. He died in a motorcycle accident on an ordinary day. It took him a while to die as he went to the hospital. I wonder what he was thinking. I hope it was, I did it all. This concludes the reading of Deep Survival, Who Lives, Who Dies, and Why by Lawrence Gonzalez. Copyright 2003 by Lawrence Gonzalez. This book was read by Stefan Rudnicki. This unabridged recording was published by arrangement with W.W. Norton and was produced in 2006 by Blackstone Audio, Inc., which holds the copyright. Neither this recording nor any portion of it may be reproduced or used for any purpose without prior written authorization from Blackstone Audio, Inc. Thank you.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.